Thank you very much, and good morning to everybody. I'm really pleased to be here, even though this idea that my podcast may already be up and, you know, I wouldn't have to give my talk sounds very tempting, it's actually much appreciated that I actually still have to do it. But I did get a chance to have a look at Deb's opening keynote yesterday, because it was already up, and she said that the level of enthusiasm could be measured by how far you come. Now, she beats me because Australia is actually a bit further than Mexico, but I still think that, you know, I'm just as pleased and happy to be here and to have the opportunity. I would have had liked to arrive at the beginning of the week because there are so many. I've been looking at the workshops and the lectures, and there's so many that I would have had liked to take myself. And but unfortunately, I only got here day before yesterday. So I appreciate the thing about the energy. I feel highly jet lagged. So I appreciate the fact that you say that, you know, that these are the kind of the last, this is the last day, and I know you've had a really hectic week. Today I'm going to talk to you about openness, about being open to the flow of information, of ideas, of people, of discourse, in short, to knowledge. And a much quoted but still relevant phrase by Newton comes to mind, and this is, if I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. Now, according to Wikipedia, it was Bernard of Chartres who compared us to dwarfs perched on the shoulders of giants. He pointed out that we see more and farther than our predecessors, not because we have keener vision or greater height, but because we are lifted up and borne aloft on their gigantic stature. Now, the point here is that we discover things because we discover truths by building on previous discoveries. But how do we know things? How do we find out about things that make us learn and let us work on new discoveries? Now, in academia, where the production of knowledge is our daily job and the reason we exist, there is a complex mechanism in place that determines where we find knowledge, how it must be expressed, what we do with it, and the processes involved that we can make it into new types of knowledge to be found by others. Now, the production of knowledge is something that is studied from numerous perspectives, you know, philosophical, pedagogical, social, cultural, etc. And my background is in library and information studies, so this is really where I'm going to be approaching this subject from. And the study of the process of scholarly communication and publishing has gained importance in the previous decades. And in particular, the advent of a network digital environment has made us rethink why we publish, how we publish, and who gets to publish. And anyway, the outline of the talk, oh, that was me introducing myself. that's where I work, the Institute for Bibliographic Studies, the Instituto de Investigaciones Bibliográficas, that's at the UNAM, which is the National University of Mexico. And then I also wanted to point out that I belong to the Red Humanidades Digitales, which is one of an association of digital humanities in Mexico and Latin America. So the outline today, I'm going to be talking first about scholarly publishing in periphery countries, then I'm going to be talking about open access, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the traditional scholarly publishing process, and then I'm going to talk about DH publishing. And somehow at the end of the talk, everything is going to come together so that you realize why I'm, you know, touching upon all these different subjects and how I think that digital humanities has a particular capacity for making participation much more global than things actually are right now in academic publishing in general. So starting with scholarly publishing on the periphery, researchers from periphery countries are sorely underrepresented in the global scholarly publishing system. We have relatively little participation in the so-called international journals, where we find a dominance of publications from researchers in developed countries. Scientific production is measured in a number of core journals that are determined by indexing services that tend to favor publications from certain regions of the world and published in English. Some of you, especially ones from libraries, may have heard about services such as Web of Science, which includes the Science Citation Index, or the Arts and Humanities Citation Index, or Scopus, which is managed by Elsevier, one of the leading journal publishers in the world. Now, none of these systems are comprehensive. These abstracting and indexing services necessarily limit the number of journals they include within their system. And then these systems help libraries and researchers to determine what materials they read, and they also work on subscription and management of these journals. So there are numerous studies that demonstrate how these journals that are published mainly in English tend to publish research from a limited amount of countries. There are numerous reasons for this and that are not related at all to the quality of the research. And in 1995, Gibbs had this this groundbreaking article which was called Lost Science in the Third World. And in there he refers to the structural obstacles and subtle prejudice that prevent researchers in poor nations from sharing their discoveries with the industrial world and with each other. Now the problem with the system is twofold. First is that researchers tend to access only these mainstream journals and they don't contemplate research published in other journals or in other languages. And secondly, when studies are done on scientific production, on scientific impact, they usually only take into consideration these core journals. So more importantly, I think, it also means that when talking about knowledge production, we limit our research by only standing on some shoulders, so to speak, or always standing on the same shoulders when we're looking to discover, you know, new knowledge. So Kanagarachan, in his book, which is A Geopolitics of Academic Writing, says that we must understand, I'm going to read the whole thing, the values of the Western intellect traditions are reflected in the conventions and practices of academic communities and their communications. How mainstream journals and their publishing practices are congenial to the interests of center knowledge while proving recalcitrant to periphery discourses, and how academic writing publishing functions are an important means of legitimating and reproducing center knowledge. So the predominance of knowledge production from a handful of countries has very important consequences. I think in particular for the humanities that require multilingual, multicultural, heterogeneous environments if we are to fully represent the wide spectrum of human diversity. So far, we have talked about who gets to publish, but now we're going to let's move on and talk about who gets to read. Most of you are probably familiar with the open access movement by now. The fundamental idea behind open access is that knowledge is produced by having access to knowledge. Barriers, in particular economic ones, with subscription prices to journal literature, hinders knowledge production. Since the 80s, libraries have been warning about the increase in the price of journals. These same journals, the mainstream or core journals that I spoke about before, are mainly produced by commercial publishers. Libraries warned that high subscription fees were causing them to have to cancel and therefore limiting access to staff and students to these publications. It is important to mention a bit of as a side note that open access movements in other parts of the world, such as Latin America, which is the one I'm most familiar with, have moved differently. And this is due to the fact that the journal publishing model is not a commercial publishing model like it is in other parts of the world. So they've always used kind of alternative business models to fund the journals. But that's really the subject of another talk, or if you have any questions at the end, we can talk about it. But with commercial publishers, if the situations were getting hard for libraries in developed economies where there's generally more funding available, for universities in periphery countries, these high costs of core journals were having very important effects. Already marginalized by language, research structure, visas, and other structural obstacles, they had not been able to read the core literature causes further marginalization. So this in turn makes it more difficult to write and publish research in mainstream journals. Now, as a side note, I think it's always important to mention that you're always going to have peripheries, you know, even in the centers. So for example, small colleges or universities in developed countries tend to suffer from this problem as well. So you might have the large, big, important research universities that have budgets or good library budgets, and then smaller colleges that don't. And it's the same thing, for example, the National University of Mexico, where I work. There's about 300,000 of us, so it's a very big university. And there's a very big library budget, so it's kind of on par with other countries. So you always have to think that, you know, sometimes it's center, but sometimes within the centers you always have the peripheries as well. So despite the library's complaints, it really wasn't until many years later when the enabling technologies of the internet and increased awareness by researchers that the open access movement was born in 2002. Now, as we shall see further on, researchers publish for a number of reasons, but one of them is to be read and to be cited by others. When researchers began to try and deposit their articles in ePrint repositories, in ePrint servers or repositories as they later became known, in order to share and communicate their work, and publishers tried to shut this activity down, they realized, I think, the dangers of knowledge productions in private enterprises. So commercial publishers with high subscription rates were limiting instead of magnifying access to knowledge. For countries on the periphery, open access was also seen as a way to increase access to knowledge that had been kind of one of the main problems to date. Now, the most accepted definition of OA is this one, and I would like to emphasize this literature, and because what literature in particular are they referring to? And what's particularly interesting, because open access tends to be thought of as, you know, the first three declarations that were done on open access. And we can see, especially with the Budapest and the Podesta one, that they really, when they're talking about this literature, they're referring to journal articles. So in the Budapest one, they talk about the worldwide electronic distribution of the peer-reviewed journal literature. And by the Podesta statement, which is in 2003, they talk about stimulating discussion within the biomedical research community on how to proceed as rapidly as possible to the widely held goal of providing open access to the primary scientific literature, probably referring once again here to journal literature. Now, something happens between, I think, the Podesta one is April or March, and then the Berlin one, which is in October, that same year, 2003. Suddenly, humanities kind of, I don't know if during the discussions, somebody from the humanities came along and said, hey, we do academic production as well, and they kind of like tried to put it in somehow. But by the Berlin one, which is at the end of 2003, it's actually called the Berlin Declaration on Open Access to Knowledge in the Science and the Humanities. And they begin to talk about contributions that include original scientific research, but they also begin to talk about raw data, metadata, source materials, and digital representations of pictorial and graphical materials and scholarly multimedia material. And then you start getting the word cultural heritage. So scientific knowledge and cultural heritage. And even at the end, you can see it says it constitutes a global and interactive representation of human knowledge, including cultural heritage. But when you actually look at the different steps and how they're going to address this issue, it's not really included, the cultural heritage. It's still kind of very focused towards journal publishing. So in practice, when we talk about open access, we tend to refer to academic publishing or academic production in a fairly vague manner. The problem, as we shall see later on, is that it's a very general term that really doesn't cover all the difficulties and complexity of academic communication and publishing. So when you look more in depth at open access examples, discussion, case studies, and so forth, it is possible to conclude that they are generally really talking about journal articles, sometimes books. And I mean, this is logical given that the open access movement was born to solve a very particular communication issue in journal publishing. However, I think it's important that we look kind of more in depth at subject-specific behavior within academic communities. The value attributed to different types of publications varies between subjects. In the sciences, for example, journal articles are the main form of communication, and books are considered less valuable forms, whilst in the humanities in general, the opposite is true. In some subjects, conference proceedings are considered valuable forms of transmission of knowledge, whilst in others, these are barely considered at all. So although open access does refer vaguely to academic production, at the heart of the examples and practical implication, it has focused more on journal production and books to a certain extent. But it doesn't fundamentally address ways of changing the publishing model. It's just more the business model. And although there are very valuable things, in particular, I think, the spirit in which it is written, in practical terms, it doesn't modify the publishing cycle to such an extent that, for example, publishers, commercial publishers, have been able to incorporate open access within their models without too much difficulty, and in some cases, quite successfully. But what about other types of scholarly production? More importantly, what about other forms of producing knowledge that have been enabled precisely by these new technologies, by this network digital environment that allows us to create new types of products and also allows us to disseminate and publish without a publisher? The impact of removing the middleman has been felt in the travel industry, in the music industry, with Ubers and with taxis. But what about the academic environment? What about the scholarly communication and publishing cycles? So now, let's finally talk about digital humanities. For me, the digital humanities is a particularly interesting example for looking at changes in publishing structures in the digital environment. The digital humanities have argued from the onset that we produce new and different types of scholarship. We mark up text, we data mine corpora, we create data sets, we provide visualizations, we create digital collections. You've probably been very busy this week doing all these types of things. And the exact characteristics and definitions of what we mean by digital scholarship and the types of outputs that we were referring to is still under discussion. So I'm going to refer to them in a kind of very general and abstract way. But there is an assumption, an underlying assumption, that these new outputs contribute to the production of knowledge and should be credited and consulted. So I am going to focus on looking at the traditional scholarly publishing cycle and then seeing how these new types of outputs impact on the different stages of what we consider a publication. There's numerous diagrams or models for the scholarly publishing cycle, and you know they all share basically the same structure. Some of them go more in depth into different stages of the cycle, so I'm providing a fairly simple one here. And the cycle of knowledge production generally commences with the data collection phase, literature review, background reading, things like that. And then the authoring and the peer review, publishing and dissemination, and then the discovery, which leads back and feeds back into the beginning of the cycle. You read other people's work, you consult other things, and you incorporate that into your new research. So what I want to do is kind of go through the cycle and point out the case of digital humanities projects as new types of research outputs within this cycle. Now, I'm not going to touch too much about data collection or the part about research, because I think the whole week you have basically been seeing how digital humanities is doing research or in the humanities in new and different ways. How you collect your data, how you consult is all these new methodologies. But one of the things, if we move on to the part about authoring, is you've probably heard it during the week, and if not, you had probably heard it before, that DH tends to be highly collaborative. So in comparison to traditional humanities scholarship, so contribution to a research product can take on many different forms. So working groups for DH projects usually require knowledge on programming and markup and visualization, images, interface, as well as the academic know-how of the subject itself. So how can this contribution be acknowledged? In traditional outputs, if we think about journal articles or in books, the author is usually the only figure we have. There's a few nuances, like you can have a first author or a second author, and you know, if you're the first author, then you get more credit. Now, in sciences that usually publish journal articles, it's become more common to have multi-authored papers, you know, some extending even to the dozens, where they have this huge list of all the participating authors. And it's not that they all wrote the paper, obviously. Each one contributed to the results of the paper in different ways. But what do we do with DH collaboration, which takes on so many different forms, and how do we find ways of crediting the different aspects that are involved in the creation of a DH project? And then what is it exactly that we author? Because we're not authoring a journal article, you know, we're authoring some kind of format of what we're creating. Is it a data set? Is it a critical digital edition? Is it an online edition? Is it a marked up Tay text? Metadata, ontologies for discovery and retrieval of a resource, retrieval. When is it a resource or a service that we're creating, and when is it indeed a contribution to knowledge. So how do we make those distinctions? When does it become this thing that helps to pass on knowledge? Moving on to the next step, which is peer review. And this is a fundamental part of the scholarly publishing process. Despite the fact that it has been shown to have numerous flaws, peer review is what we have. So how do we evaluate these types of new scholarly products that we are producing? How can you decide about the contribution it is making to the field? Reviewers are very used to seeing results and arguments presented in a very particular way. We are formed to write that way. Articles, book chapters, books are all written in a very academic style, and we use to see how these things are written as a way of deciding on its value. Now, digital humanities has been concerned about this issue and identifies it as one of the problems for the field: recognition and validation of the type of work that we do. It's very common for researchers to talk about the digital humanities projects that they do, of for which they get little or hardly any recognition. So then they have to go off and write a journal article so that, you know, they can kind of get the credit for that work that they've been doing. So there's been some attempts at providing solutions to this. The creation of guidelines to help evaluations. For example, the guidelines for the evaluation of digital scholarship in history, NINES, which works for as a peer-reviewing body for digital work in the 19th century British and American studies. There's also the criteria for reviewing scholarly digital editions from the Institute for Documentology and Scholarly Editing in Germany. There's the REDHD checklist for digital humanities projects. And indeed, last year, a new type of journal was launched by CentreNet, which is one of ADHO's constituent bodies, which is the DH Commons Journal, which seeks to provide peer review for mid-stage projects. Now, despite these important initiatives, this is not resolved at all. And a frequent issue is related to making our projects valid ways of communication, but also valid ways of a publication. And this leads me on to the next stage of the cycle, which has to do with the publisher. Traditional scholarly communication process involves a publisher as a fundamental player in the whole structure. Discussions about publishing in academia are very particular because of the essential role of publishing and publishers play in the general academic landscape. The internet has given us the capacity to make things publicly available, to disseminate widely, to publish online. So why do we need publishers at all? What is this important role that they play? Well, publishers provide a range of functions. They disseminate. They provide systems for accessing information, clarity and effective presentation. They standardize. They provide permanence, persistence, and integrity of appearance, public availability, version control, authenticity, notification, persistence of location, commitment not to withdraw. These are all different definitions about publications, quality control and archiving and long-term presentation. So basically, publishers collect material, they ensure quality, and they provide distribution and access to these publications. Now, when we publish our DH projects online, or when we put them online, we do not necessarily cover all these functions, and we might not be interested in covering them at all, actually. Some of these definitions of publishing, such as persistence and integrity of appearance and completeness of content, for example, don't even make too much sense, probably, in the digital world. So maybe what we can do is take a step back and think of publishing in more general terms. Kling and McKing make a key distinction between publishing as a communicative practice and publishing from a functionalist perspective. So as a communicative practice, our main interest, or the main reason that we publish, is we want to be read by our intended audience, and we also want to be credited for the contributions that we make. From a functionalist perspective, publishing serves to allocate status, and it also serves to allocate resources. So we have to understand publishing within a social system. We have to understand it within a reward and prestige framework, not just about communicating our results. So in the communicative aspects, publishers have traditionally been the ones in charge of making the publications available to the interested reader. A publication makes no sense if it's not read. As academics, we are interested in the impact that our work has and being read by others. This gives us recognition, which is a very valuable coin in academic environments. We write to let our results known, but also publications are an integral part of how we are evaluated, especially in quantitative-driven evaluation environments, which is more and more the case. How we publish and the number of publications that we have, but also where we publish, are a unit of measure. Things like the highly criticized journal impact factor and thankfully new types of metrics, the alt metrics, are instruments used to evaluate us. In turn, this gives us more funding, projects, invitation, and for example, at least where I come from in Mexico, we get a stimulus package from the National Science Council, depending on our productivity, that can account for a third to a half of your salary. So although information technologies allow us to publish differently, we must understand publishing in its associated structures and political implications. Changes in technology do not necessarily imply changes to customs, patterns, or behavior, or the social structures of science and scientific communication. So what happens with DH projects at this particular stage? Well, to begin with, it's very unusual for there to be a publisher. We're really usually talking about some kind of self-publishing or making available online. The researcher or the research group gets some kind of web paging going, and this is a way of communicating and publishing this information to the rest of the world. Once this is published online, these publications therefore have to be distributed in some manner and potential readers notified or made aware of the existence of these materials. So they have to be discovered somehow. There tends to be this idea that if I put something online, well then the whole world, it's there available for everybody to see, which is technically true, but people are not necessarily going to find the particular resource that you have developed. So in commercial publishing, there's large, usually subscription-based publishing platforms like Elsevier's, for example. In the case of DH, where there's usually no publisher, some publications have become known or recognized or famous through word of mouth, recognition in conferences, being used in classrooms, and generally kind of built up a reputation over time. And examples of, you know, long-standing products like the Women Writers Project and the Perseus Digital Library or the Victoria Web are kind of examples of projects that have been going on for a long time. But there are many, many, many others that are simply not easily available to be discovered by others, and therefore kind of completing the cycle of actually being discovered and then used for further research. Some initiatives, such as Intuit, which is actually quite old, the Arts and Humanities Data Service, which shut down in 2008, or the DH Common Projects Registry, have tried to address the problem by kind of creating catalogs and online discovery services, but they have been relatively unsuccessful. So why? Well, I think usually libraries who do this kind of work. The most frequent place for academic publications to end up is in academic libraries. So libraries are experts in providing search tools that provide relevant literature for academics that want to find out information about a particular subject. So this is how we tend to start our research, although this has changed quite a bit with online resources, but libraries still play an important part. So I think that the participation of libraries in DH is extremely important, and there are two reasons for this. One of them is the discovery aspects that I had just discussed, and the other one is preservation. Very few DH projects tend to have a successful, sustainable publishing model. Several people have looked into this, but many of the initial projects are just simply not there anymore. Returning to this idea of knowledge being built upon knowledge, there is a part of the scholarly communication process that requires permanence. You need to be able to look back at what others have done. So long-term access is another important issue for digital scholarship. So bringing this all together, how all of this is related. Well, in short, if we look at new types of scholarship proposed by DH, it's not just about a change of format. It has the potential to change the way we think about publishing and what types of outputs can be considered valid forms of communicating knowledge. This in turn leads to the discussion on how we validate and certify production. Fitzpatrick has talked about how in order to change the system, there needs to be substantive rethinking of the ways those faculty do their work, how they communicate that work, and how that work is read both inside and outside the academy. And what I'm proposing is that DH is strongly positioned to address this issue. DH is indeed a transformative motor of academia. It's a community which thrives on building and creating. However, we must take heed about the importance on reflecting on what it is that we're building. In this talk, I have addressed specifically our research products, our publications. So we need to see how to solve these issues related to certification, validation, and preservation of these new types of products. I think we have the opportunity to change the system as well, to be more inclusive and representative of research from different countries and languages. If we are aware of the faults and exclusions of the system we are trying to replace, then it is more likely that we can build something that does not incorporate or replicate them. So if we think about DH is kind of on the periphery of academic valid research, and then the new formats that we are producing are also kind of on the periphery of publications of what is considered valid scholarship. And if we think about periphery researchers that are working within the global academic system, how we can kind of put together, if what we're going to put together is some kind of new system to take into consideration all these different aspects. Now, how are we going to do that? Well, luckily, I only have about 2 minutes left, so it's obvious I don't know the answer. I have a few suggestions. I think we should continue to support open access. As creators, authors, make sure to make our work available, whatever the format, in this way. Who and what form will our publishers take? And when we define them, make sure that the business model that we find is useful to both readers and authors alike, and not only useful to the publishers. If we are the publishers, then assume that role completely. Maybe think about strategic alliances with libraries, because they can play an important role in the dissemination and discovery, and also in the preservation and long-term custody of what it is that we're producing. I'm still convinced that we can work on automatic translation to help us find things. A lot of problems with discovery are related to awareness. So where are we looking for information? And what is available and where we are looking? I think we should be very critical about the data sets or the data sources that we are using, especially with digitization projects. Many times when we use digitization collections that are digitized, kind of understand that maybe some things were digitized because they had the funding, and other things aren't digitized not because they're not important, but because there's not necessarily that project going on. So being very careful about that kind of work, because we have lots of very culturally rich, but not necessarily rich countries that cannot get that material online. And I think we have to start thinking about preservation issues in a kind of serious and systematic way, because we're in danger of losing many important references to previous works, and we kind of have to have a memory as a subject. I think we are just tapping the surface. We have the opportunity here to create a new type of system. Lots of things in this world related to inequality or unfairness are caused by deliberate intention, but many, I think, are just hereditary or lack of awareness. You know, sometimes we just don't think. And so as DH moves forwards towards new modes and types of academic publishing, let's try not to accidentally or unwittingly replicate some of the problems that can be identified in the old model. This is an invitation to be aware of what it means when you publish. Thank you very much.